Welcome. If I could have your attention, the first thing I need to tell you is to please turn off your cell phones. And then I'll tell you again, please turn off your cell phones. For those of you who are new, welcome to the Faith Angle Forum. Some of you are veterans and have been here many times. This is our 25th Faith Angle Forum. We've been doing this for 15 years. And we started in 1999 in Maine. And our first speaker, Elliot Abrams, was at that Faith Angle Forum. Now, you have information in your packets, and in the packets, you have the thorough bios of our speakers. So instead of just reading those bios back to you, I call your attention to them so that you can read them yourself, although you're here because you know our speakers and their reputation. But for those of you who are new, I'd like to explain just quickly some ground rules, which are after we hear from our speakers, we'll open the floor up for questions and observations. And the way we do that is that we do it in orderly fashion. I keep a running list. You just signal me that you want to get in the queue, and we'll move along as quickly as possible. There are times when something is being discussed and you're way down on the queue and you want to get in right now. So just do like this. I need to get in to make a little one-minute intervention. Now, I encourage you not to abuse that privilege, but do it if you want to butt in the line. Let me know like this. I need to tell you that we transcribe the entire conversation. Everything is on the record, unless you want to say that was off the record, and then our transcriber will keep it off the record. So especially on this topic this morning, gentlemen, if there's something you want off the record, be sure to let us know. Otherwise, everything's on the record. Now, our first speaker, we do our best to make sure these topics are timely, and we could not have begun this Faith Angle Forum with a more timely topic, as you all know. And so we feel like we have two of the leading experts on the political and religious situation in the Middle East here with us this morning, and so I'll introduce them in turn. I'll first introduce Elliot Abrams, and then I'll introduce Shadi after Elliot finishes. As you all know, Elliot served in the Bush administration as the Deputy Assistant to the President and Deputy National Security Advisor on issues related to the Middle East. He's currently a Senior Fellow of Middle Eastern Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations. And just last year, Elliot has a book out from the Cambridge University Press called Tested by Zion, the Bush Administration and the Israeli-Palestinian Conflict. I'm sure you can find one at bookstores nearby here in South Beach. It's an excellent book, and it's been favorably reviewed by people on all sides of the spectrum. So, Elliot's also the author of about five other books, which I won't name. They're in his bio. Elliot, without further ado, thank you for joining us for this Faith Angle Forum.
Thanks, Michael. Good morning. Everything's off the record, just to be clear. I teach at Georgetown in the spring terms, and I have, after long experience, banned electronic devices because I know that actually you're going to be surfing the web, looking up sports scores, and making believe that you're taking notes, but that's okay. I can't see the screen, so.
You banned them from the classroom?
I banned them from the classroom, which, by the way, I find is increasingly popular among professors because the kids are surfing the web. They are not listening. I know. If you were a better teacher, they wouldn't be, but, you know. Okay. If we had been having this discussion, 10 years ago, 20 years ago, I think that the bulk of it would have been about, and I would have begun with, the Arab-Israeli conflict, Israeli-Palestinian conflict. But that's not the central factor in the Middle East today, and President Obama said it himself in his UN speech in September. It's just not central. It rises and falls in importance, but it's kind of marginal to the main events in the Middle East. Yesterday, Mr. Baghdadi, the head of ISIS, told his folks that their prime target should be the Shia. The Shia everywhere are the ones they have to go after. Then, after all the Shia have been destroyed, they'll turn to the Saudi royal family, he said. And when that war is over, okay, then we get to the Jews. But that's, you know, that's down the road of peace. It's interesting that, you know, he chooses as the top item the Shia. He sees that as the main conflict in the Middle East. And that's not idiosyncratic. There are an awful lot of people in the Middle East who would, Sunni and Shia, who would agree with that assessment. Probably more today, 2014, than 5 or 10 years ago. Remember, it was about 10 years ago, I think, that King Abdullah of Jordan made his comment about the Shia crescent. And in the eyes of Saudis, the eyes of Iranians, that conflict is critical. It's obviously mixed with some other conflicts. For example, there is a Persian versus Arab piece of this that isn't religious. And there's simple interstate rivalries, who's the more powerful state. But the religious part of this should really not be denigrated. I think it is quite central. Stop for a minute, and when you think about the comments we are hearing from somebody like Baghdadi, okay, he's a monster. But there are lots of Sunnis in the region who have a perspective on us that is not quite so dissimilar. I mean, what is U.S. policy toward the Sunni and the Shia seen from the perspective of Sunnis in the region? Okay, there is a guy who is a Shia. In their view, he is essentially a Shia, and that's Bashar al-Assad. He's an Alawi, but it's a form of Shia Islam. And he is in the process of killing 200,000 Sunnis. And we don't care from their point of view. From their point of view, what have you Americans done? Not a damn thing. And they're aware, the more sophisticated of the debate, Secretary Panetta, Secretary Clinton recommended that we do more to support the Syrian rebels. We aren't. We haven't. So 200,000 Sunnis being killed, Americans don't care. It continues today. Artillery, barrel bombs, Sunnis being slaughtered, civilians. The Americans view this as not all that important. Now, remember about a couple of months ago, the story of the Yazidis on the mountaintop. That's when we started bombing. What percentage of Americans could have told you that day what a Yazidi is? Maybe 1/100 of 1%? What in hell is a Yazidi? What we had to bomb to save the Yazidis. Kobani. Kobani, the Americans have to save the Kurds. Not the Sunnis, not us. You don't give a damn how many of us are killed. That is a widely shared perspective, I think, in the region. Even when Bashar al-Assad uses chemical warfare against us Sunnis, you don't do anything. You back away from your red line. And what are you doing? You're in secret negotiations with Iran, with the Shia, with the Persians, and you're going to do a deal with them. Now, for those of them who read the Wall Street Journal, they read that the president wrote a letter to the Ayatollah Khamenei, which, quote, sought to assuage Iran's concerns about the future of its close ally, President Bashar al-Assad of Syria. The letter, I'm quoting, states that the U.S.'s military operations inside Syria aren't targeted at Mr. Assad or his security forces. That may be good policy. I'm not arguing against it. But what are Sunnis to make of that? Assad is slaughtering Sunni civilians every day, and that's the way American policy is presented. Recruiting for ISIS continues, and according to what I've seen in the papers, they're getting about 1,000 recruits a month. That is 1,000 young, essentially young Sunni males coming from everywhere, Europe, North Africa, Pakistan, to join ISIS. we think there may be 100 from the United States. And that argument that continues to pull on them, come help us defend our fellow Sunnis who are being slaughtered and no one cares except maybe you, so come join us. It looks to many Sunnis as if we are engaged against them. Who are these young men? And it is young men, you know, 99.9%. Particularly the ones in Europe, and there's a very substantial number, thousands from Europe. They are marginal men. They are young men who have no place in their own society. Now, that is true to a large extent, I would argue, in Morocco or Pakistan, but it's especially true in the Netherlands and France and Spain. They are marginal in the societies in which they live in Europe. They have no jobs. They have no future. They have no wives, not an insignificant point. They have no role. Their lives have no meaning in the societies in which they live. And then along comes the Islamic State, whose message we view as horrifying. But they don't, in thousands and thousands of cases, hear what we hear. The message that ISIS gives to them is, here you can have a life of meaning. Here you will have a role. Here you will have a place. Here you will serve God. Here you will help us protect your fellow Sunnis. Here you will help stop the massacres. So join us. Be an actor. Be a central, not a marginal figure. Give your life meaning. So the simple point I want to make there is that we need to understand that message, and we need to understand that whatever role our bombs have in defeating ISIS, they are going to be insufficient. There must be an ideological side to this struggle as well. Second point I want to make is one that would have been marginal, trivial 5 years ago, which is the question of Islam and democracy. And I'm going to do some quoting of Shadi Hamid, who's written as well about this as anybody. But you know, the difference, of course, is the Arab Spring in the last 3 years. The Arab Spring was, I think, largely a revolt against illegitimate regimes. And today it's led to this struggle over the role of religion in Middle Eastern societies and the role of Islam in these societies. And there is a very strong argument, Shadi has made it, that Islam and democracy are not going to mix very well. They believe in what they preach. And the political dynamic is likely, as they try to reinforce their base and defend their base from the Salafis, that political dynamic is likely to move them, let's say, further into extreme positions. And as Shadi put it once, Islamists were Islamists for a reason. They weren't liberals in disguise. A good line. They've taken the stage and they've in many cases benefited from the Arab Spring. And they're not Democrats, and they didn't get into this to be Democrats. They have a view, they have a position about what we would call Western values, individualism, liberalism. And as Shadi put it, why should Islamists with no democratic culture to speak of behave like good Democrats who believe in pluralism? Now, that's a very logical position. There are more optimistic positions about this. Olivier Roy, the French political scientist, said the Middle East is not hopelessly trapped, in his view, between old-fashioned secular dictatorships, you know, of the Mubarak variety, the Ben Ali variety, and a kind of Islamic totalitarianism. Because he thinks that the Arab Spring made a huge change, and we're beginning to witness a process of democratization, he says, which is becoming rooted in Arab societies. The process. And in his view, the Islamists are going to find themselves forced to adjust by the democratic process in which they're now engaged, the way democracy forces everybody to to move in order to win an election. And I would add that if you look at the polls, support for political Islam is not so high. There are Pew polls. There's the Arab Barometer polls that suggest that actually support for political Islam is declining and support for democracy is rising in the Arab Middle East. So there is an argument that suggests democracy is going to push Islamists toward a compromise that will be a democratic compromise. The trouble is that synthesis between Islam and democracy maybe turns out it doesn't win votes. This is the dynamic I talked about before, what Islamists want is Islam. So could we develop a synthesis in theory of Islam and democracy, in a sense, academically? Could we write it down on a piece of paper? Yeah. But the question is not whether a logical synthesis between Islam and democracy can be found. The question is whether that synthesis is going to be attractive to masses of Muslims who vote. A liberal approach to religion, a liberal approach to Islam, is easy to imagine. That's not the question. The question is whether you can sell it, whether you can market it to voters in the Arab Middle East. There's another problem, which is, what if Islamists turn to democracy? I would say this happened in Egypt. You turn to democracy because they're persuaded this is the route to power. Sure, we love democracy. Why not? It used to be that they didn't. I mean, if you go back 10 or 20 years, there was a lot of writing about how democracy is un-Islamic. But they kind of got with the program because they thought this is the route to power. Let's have an election. We're going to win. And, of course, in the immediate aftermath of the fall of the government, it is very often the case that they're the only organized force. So they win the first election. Tunisia, great example. They win the first election. But now Islamists have found things are not so easy. A, you may lose the second election. That's what happened in Tunisia. Not so surprising, because you come to power, you can't produce. Islamist parties are not known for being brilliantly sophisticated about creating jobs and improving the economy. So you lose the second election. So maybe democracy is actually not the route to power. Maybe you find that all these horrible secular parties are going to win. A. B, you may find that you do win, and then the army kicks you out, Egypt. So what happens if the Islamists conclude after, let's say, 5 years of democracy, this democracy thing is no good? It's a fraud. It's a path to defeat. Where do they turn at that point? And maybe the answer is they turn away from democracy and back toward demanding power. There's another thing I want to say here, which is, what does an Islamic democracy look like? We have we fall into the trap very often of assuming that when we say democracy, it includes the word liberalism. It includes secularism of the European and American variety. So if these countries are democratic, they say they have free elections, they have courts of law, they have freedom of speech and press. You know, they're going to look more and more and more like us. Shadi wrote, and I like this line a lot, for Islamists, well, I should start back and say, remember the phrase illiberal democracy, which may or may not have been Fareed Zakaria's phrase, but he's used it. It's a useful phrase. And Shadi wrote, for Islam, illiberal democracy. Illiberal democracy is not an unfortunate fact, unfortunate fact of life, but something to believe in and aspire to. Islamist parties have a distinctive intellectual and ideological project. That's why they are Islamists. Let me go back to Olivier Roy. In order to grasp what's happening in the Middle East, we must set aside a number of deep-rooted prejudices. First among them is the assumption that democracy presupposes secularization. The second is the idea that a Democrat must also, by definition, be a liberal. liberal in the old-fashioned sense. In what sense will they not be liberal? In two senses. One relates to religion, and the other relates to sex. And here I quote Jocelyn Cesari.
Those are big topics.
Yes. And she uses another phrase. She uses, we have illiberal democracy. She uses unsecular democracy and hegemonic Islam. If you think of the position of Christianity in Europe, yeah, I mean, the Queen is the head of the Church of England. King of Denmark is the head of the Church of Denmark. That's not, in reality, that's not hegemonic Christianity. It is symbolic Christianity. We're talking about real hegemonic religions. And what Jocelyn Cesari calls it is multiple initiatives to preserve the status of Islam as the religion of the nation through a discriminatory use of law. Concretely, it means, quoting here, that places of worship, clerics, and institutions of the dominant religion are part of the state institutions. And the central status of religion in public space is secured by blasphemy laws and limitations on conversion. So she believes that there will be an evolution toward democracy in many Arab countries, but to unsecular democracy. The limitation by law of the rights of the person on two levels, spiritual and sexual, by criminalizing blasphemy, homosexuality, and indecency. And I think we've seen that. I mean, I think we see it today throughout the region. Obviously, a lot to talk about here. We can come back to it. Now, it raises the question, you know, will the Islamists win if they tried seek power? And I've answered that in part. I think the answer is they'll win the first election, and then they stop winning. And I think we can see this in places like Malaysia and Indonesia. The bloom falls off the rose very quickly because they can't really produce. Moreover, they win because they have a reputation at the time the dictator falls, a reputation for purity, a reputation for honesty and integrity. And the word reputation is the important word because it's an image. And, you know, then they get power. And then we find that it's easy to resist temptation if there are no temptations. To what temptations were people in the Muslim Brotherhood subject under Mubarak? Temptation to go to jail. Now, all of a sudden, there's power and there's money around. And they begin to fall, some of them, into those temptations. And or they're just incompetent. They can't run the state. And so you see what happens in Tunisia. A wave of support brings Ennahda to power in the first election, and now out. I think one of the things that we are going to, that we're already seeing, I think we already see it in Egypt, we already see it in Tunisia, we'll see it in other places. The strength of the Islamists was probably heightened and exaggerated by the dictators as a strategy directed toward their own population and toward us. Namely, you may not love me, Hosni Mubarak, but it's me or the Middle Ages. It's me or those vicious, despicable Islamists. It's me or bin Laden. It's me or Baghdadi. And in order to make that prophecy come true, of course, what does somebody like Mubarak do? You don't crush the Muslim Brotherhood. You crush the liberal and centrist parties, which is exactly what Mubarak did. When that crushing ends, as it were, when things are able to sort out more naturally, we find that that's not necessarily the choice. There are parties that are much more moderate and that present different combinations of Islam and democracy. Now, I want to end with one other question. Obviously, each of these questions is worth around 9 days of debate, but I want to stop now.
We got time. We're going
to
do it here.
We have time later. We can come back to all this. There's a policy question that we will all face in the West, and particularly in the United States, which is, what do we do about the Islamists? Do we work with them or do we cooperate with governments which are trying to crush them? Shadi has written about this, what he calls the Islamist dilemma. Larry Diamond at Stanford is probably one of the foremost people arguing you've got to work with them if you think there's ever going to be democracy in the Middle East. Larry Diamond. quoting, the plain fact is that Arab countries will not achieve democracy without Islamist participation and possibly some period of Islamist leadership and governance. The challenge for these societies will be to constrain democratically elected Islamist-led government with effective constitutional checks and balances so that Islamists, once elected, cannot barricade themselves in power. Well, how do you do that? I mean, in Egypt, everybody outside the Muslim Brotherhood that I knew, left, right, and center, was clamoring for a military coup. They felt that the Muslim Brotherhood was barricading itself in power, and the only way to get it out and to move back to a chance of democracy was to remove, for the army, to remove a democratically elected president. So I think what Diamond is saying is quite logical. The question really is it realistic? Larry Diamond goes on, to isolate Islamist parties and organizations means to endorse the status quo of political stagnation in the Arab world. There is no way democratization can proceed in any Arab country today without some measure of accommodation with at least some substantial segment of political Islam. So Diamond says you've got to draw them into democratic elections, democratic governance, teaching what a loyal opposition is, pluralism, coexistence, if you're ever going to have democracy. And he's not afraid of them winning power because he says, you all heard this kind of line before, when political parties have to assume responsibility for passing legislation, crafting compromises, creating jobs, and picking up the trash, it has a leavening effect. Well, tell it to Mohamed Morsi. Does it have a leavening effect? It sure didn't have a leavening effect on him. He, to use Diamond's own phrase, he barricaded himself in power. So the question of what we should do about it then arises. I mean, I'd like to come back to this later. I want to stop talking, but I think you know what the increasingly tough line is in the region. That is, President Sisi is basically jailing everyone in the Muslim Brotherhood. The Saudis declared the Muslim Brotherhood a terrorist organization, and today the UAE declared the Muslim Brotherhood a terrorist organization, along with 82 other groups. So their view is, you don't understand, and I've had this discussion with particularly the Emiratis, you don't get it, you don't understand. There's no real difference, small difference of degree, from the Brotherhood to the people you claim to dislike so intensely, Baghdadi. These are Islamist ideologues. Some have a gun, some don't. Some have a sword, some don't, yet, anyway. Their thought is the same. And we're not willing to risk everything we've built on your academic dream that your kind of Western democracy is going to moderate them, and they will move to coexistence. So we're going to crush them now while we have the chance. And it presents a very real policy problem, I would say, for the United States, whether we are going to agree with that, approve of that, or protest and try to obstruct that move in Egypt or anywhere else. A question that comes up right now, because we're still giving $1.3 billion in aid to Egypt, and Congress, either this year or in the new Congress, is going to have to decide whether to continue that aid. I'll stop there.
But you were going to say, what do we do now?
Well, that's the question. I mean,
why don't you think about that? Because that'll be the first question that comes up.
Okay. All right.
Well, ladies and gentlemen,
bombing starts in 5 minutes. That's the usual Republican answer, right?
What did you say?
The bombing starts in 5 minutes.